Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Bob's Red Mill believes in baking, breakfast, and the pursuit of good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
All righty then. Yes, indeed, it is Monday, and it's time for What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I am your host, Katie Kiefer, and I'm excited to bring to you today one of my most favorite journalists. Her name is Maren McKenna. She is the author of Big Chicken. And we're going to talk with her in just a minute. But first, I have a few little topics to address with you in that sort of joys and sorrows segment. I don't really know what to call it anymore because it's not even joys and sorrows. I'm so beyond the joys and sorrows thing that, you know, it's just like you don't even know what to say. But I will, in the annals of sort of food fraud and food recalls, I noticed a couple of things that were really quite interesting. And one of them is that recently, 2/3 of olive oils, it didn't say how many, were tested over a 2-year period, and they were judged non-compliant with one or more chemical or organoleptic products. So that means that, once again, know where your food is coming from. I mean, you got to know the producers. It's gotten to that point. And then sort of on the heels of that, and I was reading this in foodqualitynews.com, by the way, which you can subscribe to too. It's free. In Food Quality News, the following companies have made food and beverage alerts for recalls. And those countries are USA, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, England, Scotland, Belgium, France, Germany, Switzerland, Croatia, Lithuania, and Denmark. All of these countries are making alerts to their populations who probably are not getting them, but someone is hearing them, but not the people who are buying these products. But among the lists of things that are being found as adulterants in food and beverage products around the world, just get this, you guys. I mean, this is really kind of distressing. Botulism, insect excrement, cleaning fluids. And then there were other recalls related to listeria, allergens, and patulin. I don't even know what that is. Fipronil, which sounds like a medication. Milk and listeria was a problem. Norovirus, Clostridium botulinum, and Salmonella were all part of recalls. Those were probably on meat. Recalls included products that were contaminated with E. coli 026, cyanide, and unauthorized additives, and acrylamides, which is another sort of product that is used in agriculture. And then there was another recall for cryptosporidium and then, of course, the very benign language labeling. So that's kind of it for my joys and sorrows, only because I'm a little pressed for time and I want to have a lot of time with Maren. It blows my mind that there are so many things that are creeping into the food supply that we just have absolutely no idea of what or why or how they get in there. And yet, despite all of the efforts and the money that goes into maintaining the safety of our food supply, and I have to say that here in the United States, we are in general pretty lucky compared to many other countries. But I mean, it is mind-blowing just how much goes on without people really being aware of it. So on that note, I will say once again, just know your farmer, know your food or whatever. Just be mindful of where you're getting your stuff and read the labels and don't buy things with a lot of ingredients in them because then you don't get a lot of the extra things that you don't actually want. So we're going to take a short sponsor drop. We'll be right back with the wonderful Maren McKenna. We're going to talk Big Chicken and you will enjoy every minute of this program and it will scare the daylights out of you. Stay tuned.
We'll be right back. Bob Moore is the founder of Bob's Red Mill, the top quality supplier of grains, flours, and general nutritional goodness from Oregon. He's talking to us about their signature millstones, a very specific way of making whole grain flour. So what's the secret, Bob?
Follow me to the mill room. Well, these are just like the millstones that the Romans used to grind their grains. In fact, these stones came from the same quarry near Paris, France, where the Romans got their stones. The company that makes our millstones pulls their quartz from the same quarry, and they make mills for us that are just wonderful.
Bob explains how the millstones grind much slower and at cooler temperatures than modern steel rollers. The process keeps the grains cool, preserving the flavor and nutrition.
Look at what they produce. I love how they keep things simple and just right. All the nutrition is there, just like nature intended.
After almost 40 years in the milling business, they're serving up over 400 organic, gluten-free, and whole grain foods right here from the mill in Oregon, sending them off to destinations around the world.
We think we can make a difference by sticking to the traditional way of stone milling. And so, that's what we're doing.
To learn more about Bob's Red Mill and their mission to bring good food for all, visit bobsredmill.com/podcast.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and we're today talking with the wonderful Maren McKenna. Maren is an award-winning journalist and author specializing in public health and food policy. Her work has appeared in National Geographic, The New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic, Wired, Scientific American, and Slate, among many other publications. Her 2015 TED Talk, What Do We Do When Antibiotics Don't Work Anymore, has been viewed over 1.4 million times. She is also the author of the award-winning books, Super Bug and Beating Back the Devil, on the front lines with the disease detectives of the Epidemic Intelligence Services, and her new book, Big Chicken, the incredible story of how antibiotics created modern agriculture and changed the way the world eats, published by National Geographic. Maren is a senior fellow of the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University and a frequent radio guest. She's been a frequent radio guest on this program. And Maren, welcome to the program. What can I say? Happy to have you back.
Thanks for having me back. It's so nice to talk to you.
And congratulations are in order on a wonderful book. It was really fantastic.
Thank you.
I took so many notes that it took me a really, really, really long time to read it. But that was a good thing. I mean, it was so jam-packed with information. It's really exceptional. So let's just start with the basics, because this book is about how antibiotics changed American agriculture, basically, or American livestock agriculture. Can you first explain to people what antibiotic resistance means and how do antibiotic resistant pathogens transfer to humans?
Sure. So the easiest way to explain antibiotic resistance is this. Long ago, long before humans ever came on the scene, when the world was only a bacterial world, bacteria made compounds, chemical compounds, to compete against each other, to compete for living space, for sources of nutrition. And just as bacteria were leveling these compounds against each other, bacteria would also evolve protections against the other bacteria's compounds. So if a compound was intended to dismantle the outer membrane of a bacterium, they would fix their membrane. If it was intended to get inside the membrane and explode the bacterium in some manner, they would protect themselves against that. We took those compounds into the lab and made synthetic versions of them and then took them back out into the world again, and bacteria learned to defend themselves against our versions just as they had against the versions that originated in the bacterial world. And that defense is antibiotic resistance. It's bacteria's way of defending themselves against the compounds, the chemical weapons, essentially,
right,
that we level against them to kill them.
That's right. Interesting.
So,
they travel to humans.
A bacterium becomes resistant, and then it migrates through the world, and then when we try to cure an infection with that bacteria using antibiotics, then the bacteria don't respond.
Right. That's a scary thought. So let's do a quick overview. I know it's really hard to do that, but let's try, of how antibiotics came to be an integral part of livestock agriculture. Because that sort of, it was like it sprang upon the scene and then it just kind of took over. So can you give us just a sort of thumbnail of how that happened?
Sure. So the funny thing is that, you know, I feel like people who are alert to problems in the food system have the sense that the conversation about antibiotic use in raising meat animals is a relatively recent thing. But in fact, this practice and the conversation about it actually goes back to the beginning of the antibiotic era, which is the late 1940s. So the first antibiotic to be on the scene, penicillin, reaches the open market in about 1944, and all the other drugs, four or five drugs that together establish the beginning of the antibiotic era, are all out on the market by 1950. So those are all, and they change the world. They are incredibly important because they suddenly cure, rampant infections that otherwise killed people in terrible ways before antibiotics came along.
Absolutely.
Infections that arose from really minor injuries, from scratches, scrapes, cuts, as well as from attempts at surgery and from the kind of infections that we think of as childhood infections, like pneumonia and scarlet fever and so forth. So antibiotics are this amazing gift to medicine. And then one of the manufacturers of one of those first antibiotics, a smart chemist working at one of those companies, decides to see whether they can open up an additional market for their drug. So the drug is oreomycin, the trade name for which is chlortetracycline, and this chemist's name is Thomas Jukes, and he's actually an expert in the dietary needs of chickens. But he ends up at this company, Letterly Laboratories, and not on their antibiotic team exactly, but looking for supplements to add to the diets of animals, because in the wake of World War II, there's been a real shock to the meat production system, and they're looking for ways to cut costs as a result of that shock. So Jukes takes the manufacturing leftovers from his company's drug, chlortetracycline, and he adds them in an experiment to the diets of baby chickens, along with various other kinds of supplements. And when he weighs those chickens at the end of his experiment, the chicks that have gotten the manufacturing leftovers, which contained trace amounts of their drug, oreomycin, have gained much more weight than any of the other chicks in the experiment, using a substance that the company was essentially going to throw away.
Wow.
And it takes them a little while, not very long, actually, to figure out what the dosing is, what the equivalent would be if you were actually taking the refined drug and putting it into livestock feed. And that dosing is only grams per ton of feed. Yet, even though it's grams, within 5 years from the end of that experiment, American farmers are giving 500,000 pounds of antibiotic a year to their livestock. And now it's, 34 million a year in the United States.
Whoa. That's staggering. And we're going to talk in a minute about how much we use now. But even as early as 1947, they had red flags about antibiotic resistance already showing up. And yet nobody seemed to, even Jukes himself just poo-pooed that. Isn't that true?
It's really perplexing to me looking back at this, because right from the start of the antibiotic era, there were warnings that if we put antibiotics out in the world, bacteria were going to react the way they always had, which is to say antibiotic resistance, the loss of the power of antibiotics, was going to develop. The discoverer of penicillin, Alexander Fleming, warns about it in his Nobel Prize acceptance speech in 1945. He tells people not to use these drugs casually because they are precious and we will lose their power. And as you say, by 1947, as a result of misuse in medicine, antibiotic-resistant bacteria are already sweeping the globe. Now, to give the people who put antibiotics into animal feed some minimal credit, they did, I think, when I go back and I read the earliest papers, of which there were very many, this was a very interesting result that animals would gain weight when you gave them these doses. And there was some concern that antibiotic-resistant bacteria were going to arise in the animals, in their guts, because what happens is they're fed these antibiotics as part of either in their feed or in their water, and the right. antibiotics go into their guts where bacteria are already residing, as is true for all of us. But what they thought was that the resistant bacteria would stay confined to the animals, and that there would effectively be no downside, because if a certain percentage of resistance developed in the animal's guts, then the growth promoters, as they were calling these antibiotic doses, would just stop working. What they never seemed to consider is that gut contents of an animal don't stay inside the animal. they either exit as manure, or they become exposed when the animal is disassembled at slaughter and turned into right. meat. And that's those, we can talk about this, but those are the pathways by which the antibiotic-resistant bacteria that arise as a result of farm antibiotic use get away from the farm and threaten human health.
That's right. And then you went on to say that in 1957, you know, after the poultry industry kind of blew up and suddenly everybody was having chicken every day, you know, it was sort of faltering. And there was a huge meeting on Capitol Hill with all of the, you know, big chicken concerns and, you know, governors and so on, to sort of address the flatlining of chicken consumption. And there was this, appeared to be this tremendous willingness to allow consolidation on a grand scale. In other words, nobody was waving a red flag about, big company, you know, Tyson and Purdue gobbling up all the small farms around them. They seem to be totally on board with that, with the exception of one person named Margaret Neff Stetzel, who was advocating for smaller farmers. Describe how that happened. I mean, what was going on there? Like, why were people not concerned about the monopolization of the industry, especially given that it was not so far after the Sherman Act had been passed and so forth? The Sherman Act being the antitrust.
There's a really fascinating sort of cycle to me in this history of the poultry production industry, which I use poultry to tell the story of antibiotic use in agriculture, because that first experiment was conducted in chickens, and because, as I'm sure we'll get to, chicken plays a really interesting role right now in our reconsideration of antibiotic use in agriculture. But this interesting cycle is that time and time again, supply of chicken gets out in front of demand, mm-hmm. and the industry has to do something to fix the lack of demand. And this moment that you're talking about, these hearings in 1957, is one of those moments when there's just too much chicken and not enough people are buying chicken, and the industry is trying to figure out what to do about that. And you know, it's really I went back and I read all the transcripts of the original sure. congressional hearings, and it's really amazing how all these companies are willing to just to let capitalism reign. That consolidation, they consider that consolidation is the natural result of an industry becoming more mature, that they're all going to buy each other, that they're all going right. to produce as much chicken as they can. They actually say to congressmen, you know, if any one of us tries to be responsible and backs away from making so much chicken, no one else is going to follow us, and we're just going to lose out in this burgeoning marketplace. We have to compete as much as we can. We have to buy other companies. We have to force down our prices as much as possible. And yeah. that one lone farmer is so... Actually, she's not a farmer. She's a hatchery operator.
Yeah.
It's so interesting to me that she is one of the few voices speaking against this. There's actually several times in this history when women speak up and are sort of the lone voices of reason in this otherwise rush toward production. Of course they're not listened to.
Of course not. Testosterone and money. I don't know. It's, it's a deadly combination, isn't it? Well, one of the things that really... drove chicken consumption, I think, is you spoke about acronization, which was actually a totally new concept even to me, and you know how much I love the meat industry. And that was all about making people, you know, feel more secure about buying chicken, perhaps over other protein products. What was acronization and what did it do?
This is the most bizarre story.
I thought it was scary.
And
unbelievable.
I feel a little validated that you have never heard of it. It turns out that almost no one has heard of it.
Indeed,
and
Aaron.
At first, when I sort of stumbled across it in my research, I really didn't believe that this had happened. I even, through a friend, got to meet one of the FDA's archivists and asked if they could help me find any records of this, and they looked at me like they had never heard of this either.
Really?
But you know, in multiple old news stories and old newspaper advertisements and letters to the editor and grocery store advertisements, I demonstrated that this did go on. So what was acronization? Acronization was yet another attempt, first by the company that came up with growth promoters in the first place, Letterly Laboratories and Thomas Jukes, to find yet another market for their drug, while also doing a few other things. And what this represents is after animals that had been fed antibiotics throughout their lives, however their lives were slaughtered and disassembled and turned into pieces of meat, that meat, primarily chicken and fish, was dunked into a solution of dissolved antibiotics and then packaged. And the idea was this coating of live active antibiotic would serve to suppress spoilage bacteria so that you could move meat, you could put meat in a cold case in a grocer and have it last for weeks instead of for days. Or you could ship it, you know, into the center of a continent where there were not, into across South America or across Australia, where there were not sufficient refrigerated ships or railroads. So the idea was, while making more money for this company, to the idea was to increase the supply of chicken.
Right.
Make chicken and fish more available. And some of the early experiments are just hair-raising. I mean, there are accounts of they tried to do things like feed very high doses of antibiotic to chickens before they slaughtered them, or to pump antibiotic into the veins of cattle before they cut their throats. But in the case, so the chickens didn't really want to eat all that much antibiotic, and the cattle, they concluded first they couldn't get the cattle to stand still long enough, and also that it took way too much antibiotic to perfuse their muscles, and it was really easier just to dunk them after they were dead.
Wow, absolutely incredible. And, you know, at the same time, like in the debate over this, which I sort of seem to have stumbled upon when I first started doing this show, you know, I would go to these Animal Agriculture Alliance meetings, and sometimes they would even invite me to speak, which was completely insane of them. But anyway, they would say things like, and I think I alluded to this in one of my questions, but they would say things like, well, you know, nobody uses tetracycline anymore, so what, you know, who cares whether we use it or not? I mean, and they were still saying things like, well, we don't use them indiscriminately, they're too expensive, which, you know, I think staved people, you know, made people think that, oh, well, they're using it judiciously because it costs farmers so much money. But that's not really true. You just proved that by the idea that they were dunking pieces of meat in antibiotic solution. I mean, who, you know, somebody is paying for that. Who would pay for that? The Packers? I mean, they would object to that.
Yeah, it would have been the Packers. And in fact, so after Letterly, American Cyanamid came up with this Pfizer, the still existing drug company Pfizer, had a rival process that was very similar. They had a similar drug with a slightly different molecule. Mm-hmm. They both got licenses from the FDA to do this, and they required packing houses to essentially buy licenses from the company in order to and go through a sort of certification process. So it was a double kind of income stream for them, both because they were buying the drug and also because they had to pay the companies for the right to use the drug in this manner.
Right.
You know, I mean, people have said, no one would misuse antibiotics, because, as you say, because they are a cost. But in fact, they just haven't been that much of a cost, because most of the drugs that have been used historically were drugs that in this indiscriminate manner, not the drugs that are used therapeutically to cure animals, but the ones that were used preventatively and as growth promoters, were drugs that are now, you know, they've been generic for a very long time.
Right.
Generics are just not that expensive. On my desk at home, I have a 2-pound bag of oreomycin chlortetracycline that I bought off the internet. And I think it cost me, you know, I don't know, $20, something like that.
Wow. And that would probably be enough. I mean, you know, I don't want to waste time doing the how many grams go into how many pounds of feed, but that would probably do a dose it's of a fair number of birds. Yeah, right, right, exactly. But let's move on from that, because that the whole acronization thing was just such a mind blower. But you know, when we're talking about antibiotic resistance, and this was post acronization, I guess, because eventually it was phased out, right? There was something called the Swan Report in England, and I wanted you to talk a little bit about that, because that was really quite an explosive report on the impact of the overuse of antibiotics. And you know, describe what that was and how the U.S. responded to that.
So the interesting thing about the problem of antibiotic-resistant bacteria emerging from farms is that it takes a while for anyone to notice. And that's partly because even there, consolidation, as we talked about, has been happening at the same time. And so even the concept of very large outbreaks of foodborne illness is a relatively new development. And suddenly we have very large outbreaks of antibiotic-resistant foodborne illness. This is something that science and public health just haven't seen before, and it takes a while for them both to get their minds around this and also to try to figure out how to trace back the evidence from sick people through wholesalers, through middlemen to farms. Once they do, and this happens first in England, and my hypothesis for this is that England is where I grew up, and it's just a smaller place. You know, agriculture and towns and cities are more interpenetrated, and they especially were more interpenetrated in the 60s. In the town where I grew up in the 60s and 70s, there just wasn't, you know, you didn't have to go very far outside the town to see cattle and sheep.
Sure.
They were just naturally there. They're not sequestered thousands of miles from major population centers the way we do in the United States.
Right.
So people started noticing that there were these outbreaks of antibiotic-resistant foodborne illness, that's Salmonella, Campylobacter, E. coli, that seemed to be associated with the meat from animals that had been given antibiotics as they were grown. And this became such a concern that eventually the British government becomes the first national government to start to examine this practice that now has existed for about 20 years
right.
of routinely giving antibiotics to animals. And they impanel a commission, which is what governments do. And the head of that commission is Dr. Michael Swan, who at the time was the chancellor of a university and later went on to head the BBC. And 2 years later, they come out kind of stunningly with this report, the famous Swan Report in 1969, which says growth promoter antibiotics were a mistake and they should be phased out. And by 1971, the British Parliament has accepted that judgment, though it certainly is controversial at the time, and that becomes the first national control of farm antibiotic use, which is followed down the road by Scandinavia and then by the rest of Europe, but not by the United States, because the United States finds itself in a difficult political situation that actually lasts for decades.
Mm-hmm. It's still ongoing, as far as I can tell. Am I right? I mean, you know, we still haven't completely phased them out. We're going to talk about the guidances in a minute. But in part of your chapter, Epidemics as Evidence, which I think is also the Swan Report was included in that, is you make the point that epidemics provided the concrete evidence of animals harboring antibiotic-resistant pathogens and that they were transferring those germs to the humans. And yet in 1998, we still had no regulation over how much and how antibiotics were being used in agriculture. Can you describe why the industry, the American industry, was able to continue to insist, despite the scientific evidence to the contrary, that antibiotic resistance was not from animal ag, and that it was really just because, you know, we had misused antibiotics in hospital settings? Because, I mean, as I said, you know, when I was giving those talks way back when to the Animal Agriculture Alliance or the NIA or whatever, you know, people were still like, no, there's no evidence to support that there's any transference of these germs. I'm not kidding you, Maren. They were saying things that Dick Raymond, who was the Undersecretary of Agriculture, I don't know when, in the 80s or something, he was saying, well, it doesn't matter. As long as one works, then it doesn't matter if all the rest of them don't work. You know, we're fine. We're okay. You can keep using them. They're good. I mean, it was, you know, it was really a mindset that was universal in animal ag, at least in large-scale animal ag. And I really was, I was quite pilloried at one meeting where I gave a talk about antibiotics. They didn't like it all. I'm sure you've had this experience where the entire room goes absolutely dead silent and everyone is giving you the stink eye at once. I mean, it was like I could have dropped right through the stage at that moment. But anyway, yeah, I was not popular, and they have since stopped inviting me for these things. But not to talk about me, but of course, let's talk about me. No, I'm just kidding. But I mean, why is it that, I mean, how have they managed to wield so much power that they have successfully avoided having really any laws, shall we say, never mind regulations, laws that prevent the excessive use of antibiotics? It just does not make sense to me. It's like outsized power.
So a couple of things. To unpack your question, there's a couple of things that were going on at the same time that made it possible to deny this effect, which I think now is, you know, very reasonably established, hundreds and hundreds of scientific papers that draw this connection very clearly. The first is that no regulation, no law or regulation was allowed for decades. And the reason for that goes back to the aftermath of the Swan Report. After the Swan Report was approved by the British Parliament in 1971, we had already started to look here in the United States about the potential effect of antibiotic use in animal agriculture. So the Carter administration comes in 1976 with a whole raft of earnest young reformers wanting to really change the government. And one of those reformers is a scientist named Donald Kennedy, who is on loan from Stanford University. He's a very prominent biologist. He gets made the head of the FDA. And he is shocked that this rampant antibiotic use has not yet been addressed now, more than 20 years after 30 years after Jukes' experiment, more than 20 years after the FDA grants licenses for it. And he announces he is going to hold a hearing in which the manufacturers of these drugs must show up and provide evidence that their drugs are not, the use of their drugs in animals is not harming human health. And if they can't provide that evidence, then he's going to yank the licenses that the FDA gave 20 years before. And he never gets to hold that hearing.
Really?
Because a powerful congressman named Jamie Whitten from Mississippi, who is the head of the committee that oversees the FDA's budget, sends a message up to the Carter White House that if this hearing goes forward, he, Whitten, is going to hold the entire FDA's budget hostage.
No kidding.
The Carter White House has a lot of other reforms in mind. This is the point in time where they're arguing about other supplements. They're arguing about saccharin. They have a lot of things they want to do with the FDA. And so they turn around and they tell their new FDA commissioner, no hearing. You will not consider what is happening with antibiotic use. You will not impeach those licenses. So Kennedy sort of throws up his hands, and 2 years later, he goes back to Stanford. And Whitten, there's a sting in the tail of this, which is that Whitten, in the appropriation bill that he allows to go through, he puts in a rider that is renewed every Congress that there will be no legislation impeaching animal antibiotic use as long as he is there to sponsor this. And that rider gets renewed and renewed and renewed up until the 1990s.
Wow.
Until he retires. So he's at the point at which he retires, he's the longest serving member of the House of Representatives. So first, that's a long answer to part of the question of how is it that people could claim that there was no effect. So one reason is because it hadn't been legally proven. The second is that though it was scientifically proven to the agreement of every epidemiologist and microbiologist, but in fact, if you wanted 100% ironclad proof, that is not the kind of observational epidemiologic proof that public health takes for granted, you had to kind of wait for the development of very modern molecular tools. So now we can do whole genome sequencing very inexpensively on a bacterial isolate from a sick person and construct a phylogenetic tree that helps us trace back through the molecular clock of mutation, you know, what has happened, where this has come from, and how long it's likely to have been out there and so forth. And it makes it much, much more reliable. A piece of evidence. So, so both science and regulation caught up with proving a thing that, you know, anyone who had any eyes accepted as happening decades ago.
Well, one of the things I didn't include this in the outline, but I want to bring it up anyway. when you discuss the way that they are able to trace particular isolates and identify the genetic markers of various bacteria, antibiotic resistant bacteria, is was through the discovery of urinary tract infections that were intractable, that could not be treated.
So this is an extraordinary story to
yes.
me. You know, I think at this point, anyone who's paid attention to this issue kind of understands that these bacteria migrate off farms because they are, as I said, they've been created in the guts of animals. So they move either on the meat that the animals become, or they move out of the animals in manure, and through that manure they move into the wider environment.
Right.
But people kind of have an association in their heads that all of this antibiotic-resistant bacteria has to do with foodborne illness, it came from the animal's guts, it has something to do with our guts, things like Salmonella, Campylobacter, and so forth, E. coli.
Mm-hmm.
They are willing to accept that association. But the involvement of farm-related antibiotic-resistant bacteria in urinary tract infections and in the infections that come from those, which includes kidney infections and septic shock, that yeah. is something very new to people because it involves a different organ system. And what's uh-huh. happening here, and any woman who's ever had a UTI will instantly understand this process, right. is these bacteria are in our guts, but then at a certain point they kind of sneak out of our guts and into our urinary systems, and they create a resistant UTI, which to the average doctor, if they don't think to do testing, will look not like a UTI that's not responding to antibiotics, but like a woman getting infected over and over and over again.
Yeah.
So they just keep prescribing antibiotics. She doesn't realize why she's not getting cured. That infection is effectively being untreated because she's being given antibiotics that don't work for it. And so it's free to spread up through her body, into her kidneys, into her circulation, and to cause, you know, sepsis and pneumonia and bone infections and just terrible, terrible sequelae. And the one estimate by one of the top researchers who's looking at this problem, which is known as foodborne UTIs, is that possibly 10% of the UTIs that occur in this country every year could have a foodborne component, in which case that's possibly 600,000 cases a year.
Whoa. That's a staggering number. I have to admit that there was a personal reason that I asked this question, which is that my mother had this, and her urologist was unable. He had, because this was over 10 years ago, no clue. Kept treating her over and over and over again with Cipro, which was, you know, had millions of unpleasant side effects for her, and really at one point almost killed her. But anyway, well, let's move on. I just wanted people to know that is, you know, that's just one of the ways in which these antibiotic-resistant bugs masquerade as something else, or something that you would never associate with foodborne illness. And MRSA is another one. I don't want to get too bogged down in it, but it's, you know, people think of that as a hospital-borne disease, and maybe it started out that way, but then it moved into the hog industry and poultry, and then back into people. Isn't that right?
Right. So the story of what people call livestock-associated MRSA, or most people just who know about it call it just pig MRSA, is a really interesting story because it proves so clearly the connection between farm antibiotic use and human illness. And the very short version of the story is this, that in the early 2000s, in the Netherlands, which is a country that has extremely tight control of antibiotics at a government level in medicine, suddenly there was a bloom of MRSA, drug-resistant staph, methicillin-resistant staph aureus, in pig farmers. And no one could figure out why this was. And it turned out, when they looked at the numbers, though the Netherlands was incredibly responsible with its antibiotic use in humans, it had left a back door open, and it was one of the highest users of antibiotics in livestock in the European Union, and the drug they were using the most was tetracycline. Which is a drug that was not used in humans for drug-resistant staph infections, of which there were very few in the Netherlands. So this this resistant staph that started out in pigs, leapfrogged to pig farmers, moved into the wider society, really caused havoc in the Dutch healthcare system, was a staph that was resistant to tetracycline. And that was a big red flag pointing back to the use of tetracycline on pig farms, because the only alternative explanation would have been that people who had drug-resistant staph would have been people who were given tetracycline and the staph became resistant in them. But right. They weren't getting tetracycline. It wasn't being used for staph in the Netherlands. The only place where the exposure to the antibiotic was occurring was in the animals on farms.
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. I'm going to rush you right along here because I want to talk for a second about foster farms, and then we're going to go back and talk about solutions, including what the Netherlands have done, the French have done, and other countries, and what we can learn from them. But let's talk for a second about the foster farms outbreak, because foster farms was sort of held up as kind of the poster child of responsible large-scale animal production or chicken production, right? They had a very...
So Foster Farms is a company that it's one of the major chicken producers in the United States.
Yeah.
And it's extremely dominant on the West Coast.
Yeah.
And in 2012 and then again in 2013 and continuing to 2014, there is a very large outbreak of drug-resistant illness associated with Foster Farms chicken. It makes sick more than 600 people who are diagnosed in 30 states and territories. And
wow.
The CDC's usual multiplier for the actual size of a foodborne illness mm-hmm. epidemic is that for every person who is sick enough to go to the doctor, is diagnosed, and is associated with an outbreak, there might be 30 or more people who
sure.
either never go to the doctor or never get linked back to that outbreak, which means that this outbreak had thousands, potentially, of victims. And I talked to one of them in the book.
Right.
The thing is, what is extraordinary about this outbreak is really that it's not extraordinary, that there are very large outbreaks all the time associated with antibiotic resistance and with food being distributed across the country. And it's very hard to figure out these outbreaks because the illnesses are often very separated, both in distance and in time, from mm-hmm. the antibiotic use that caused them. Now, what was interesting about Foster Farms is, as you say, they were thought of as a very, you know, they were a family-owned company. They'd been going for more than 70 years. They were thought of as very, very responsible. And yet they had this perplexing, you know, and very stubborn outbreak that was very, very hard to pin down. And one of the senior foodborne illness scientists at the CDC eventually suggested that what might be going on here was a thing that he'd been worried about for a while, which is that, you know, when chickens are killed in a processing plant, their necks are slit, and then they're bled out, and they're defeathered in these big rotating drums, and then they are dunked into an ice and water bath to bring the body temperature down rapidly so that they don't
right.
start to spoil. So what this very smart scientist, Dr. Robert Toakes, observed was that when the bird is warm, when it's in that scalding bath to loosen the feathers, all of the pores in the skin and the follicles where the feathers have been yanked out of are all going to be wide open because of the heat.
Right.
But then you toss them into the ice bath, and all of them are going to close back up again, just like, you know, when you read in a teen magazine as a young girl that you're supposed to pat your rinse your face with cold water to close your pores.
Yeah.
So when they closed back up again, they were potentially trapping disease bacteria in them. And the bacteria could then, but then the chicken might warm up some as it moved further down the processing
sure.
line and was cut apart into parts and packaged. And thus, any bacteria that had gotten into the pores of the skin in that defeathering whirling could leak out again and contaminate a package. And that is, in fact, what Foster Farms went after when they decided, in the wake of the outbreak, to improve their processes further. The examinations of chickens on the line showed that, though it seemed like there was a very, very low rate of salmonella on whole chickens,
yeah.
When they checked the chickens after they had been cut apart and warmed up a bit, there was there was salmonella present.
Wow!
And that was a surprise. And all that had changed was that the birds had warmed up a little bit and the pores in the skin had opened.
Fascinating.
So
Maren.
The company adjusted a number of their processes, and now it's actually considered a model for the industry because their rates of recovery of bacteria are so low. It was yet another one of those sort of unintended consequences, and also an unintended consequence of the way that our consumption patterns have changed, because it used to be that people only bought whole chickens.
Right.
But it's the extra time on the line cutting the chickens apart, because now we prefer to buy chicken parts
right.
that made the birds vulnerable to further contamination.
Incredible. And so have other companies, to your knowledge, adopted some of the practices that Foster Farms has pioneered in terms of managing that disease load?
You know, when I read the trade industry publications, of which I read many,
of course.
It does seem like
fascinating.
This has definitely become a model for the industry and a way of being alert to this unexpected danger.
Absolutely.
There's a number of things that right now are propagating through the industry, including relinquishing antibiotics entirely.
Well, then let's go to that, because we are running out of time. And it was very encouraging when a few years ago now, Purdue announced that they had spent the preceding decade phasing antibiotics out of their production line. And other companies have followed, except, of course, the Sanderson Company, which has famously said they will rather die, apparently, rather kill all of us than change their practices. But have you seen a sort of pulling back? Have you seen other companies really sort of starting to adopt Purdue's methodology in terms of better hygiene, probiotics, vaccines, et cetera, in order to avoid using antibiotics so frequently?
So I think that, that Purdue, as you say, they definitely were the people who led the parade on this. In 2014, this, family company still run by a grandson of the founder stood up and said, "We are relinquishing antibiotics. Our goal is to be antibiotic-free." And they shocked the rest of the industry. They are the fourth largest chicken company in the United States, and they really set a model for the sort of a challenge for the rest of the industry to follow. There's no question that there's a movement by most of the chicken companies, with a few outliers, as you observed, to reduce antibiotic use. And they're doing this not so much because they believe or disbelieve in the movement of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. They're doing it simply because customers have asked them to, Customers of various sizes, from families up to big buying systems, have told the industry that they are concerned about this and don't want to spend their money on meat that is raised with routine antibiotic use. But some companies are going antibiotic-free. Some companies are switching only to antibiotics that are not used in human medicine, such as the drug category ionophores, which, if we can get out the drugs that are used in human medicine, that means we'll no longer be creating resistant bacteria that would put humans at risk, right? Because we won't have undermined the drugs that are used in human medicine to cure these. Mm-hmm. And a few companies in various parts of the world are doing they're sacrificing antibiotics, but instead of going back to sort of older practices such as refining diets or giving birds more space or giving them light, which are the sort of things that Purdue is doing, they're instead moving toward much more robotic, hands-off operations, making broiler farms more like the very big caged egg farms, on the assumption that it's contact with humans that somehow transmits disease bacteria. And if you can create a system of growing broilers in which the first time they're touched is the day that they die, then maybe you can reduce bacterial load that way.
Wow. I didn't know that. Did you put that in your book? Did I miss that?
Well,
fascinating.
I think I didn't, actually. But I wrote a story for Slate when I went to one of these farms.
Right.
There was just no room in the book. But I went to a demonstration farm run by the Dutch created by the Dutch company Vencomatic, which is a company that builds growing systems, like builds barns and egg-laying barns and so forth. And it was like a matrix for chickens. It was a warehouse with broilers being grown on 6 levels, and the levels were what looked like trays with litter in them. And on the day that the birds were going to be slaughtered, the levels all turned into slow conveyor belts that carried the birds from the spot where they had originally been hatched to the end of the warehouse and dropped them into crates and placed them on the truck.
And then take them. Oh, my God, Maren, that is so horrible. And I actually saw today on my Facebook feed, you know Greg Gunthorpe, right, from Indiana, the pig farmer? Well, anyway, he's worth knowing. And he posted a picture today of a pig CAFO that is, instead of being, big sort of one-story houses, it's 8 floors. It's exactly what you just described, except for it's for pigs. I was just...
Is it in China?
I think it might be. It probably should be.
I keep hearing stories about multi-level pig farms in China, but I haven't seen any pictures yet, so I'll look that up.
It's just, it's beyond revolting. But anyway, unfortunately, I think we have to wrap it up here, even though I've enjoyed this conversation more than I can say, and I might have to bring you back till we can talk about it some more. But in the meantime, I will do for you what I did not do for my last guest, which is give you a chance to promote yourself shamelessly. Where are you appearing? And then I'll give him a plug in afterwards, because Ted Genoways actually did a pre-record with him. So anyway, about his wonderful book, This Blessed Earth. So you guys should be on like a twin bill. You should be a double headers somewhere. Wouldn't that be so cool?
So I am Maryn McKenna, and people can find out more about me at marynmckenna.com, MarynMckenna.com. The website for the book is bigchickenthebook.com, where all the events and are listed, and shortly all the excerpts and reviews and so forth will be too. It's been a busy couple of weeks. I haven't got them all up. And if anybody wants to follow me on social media, on both Instagram and Twitter, I am MarynMckenna.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And folks, next week you will be hearing the interview that I did today with Ted Genoways and about his book, This Blessed Earth. And really, you should read these two in tandem. It was very interesting. You have to read them back to back. I enjoyed the process and learned so much from both of you. And I really appreciate you guys. The work that you do is so important, and it's just everything I can do to help promote it, I certainly shall. So thank you, Maryn, for joining me. Thanks to Bob's Red Mill, my sponsor today. And we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening, folks. Bye-bye now.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.